Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.
As a parent of three kids, energy transition is so important to me. I mean, this is the legacy we're trying to leave for the next generation. I don't trust utility companies and diversified energy companies to make those decisions quickly. I think it really has to come for these pure play companies.
Distributed generation doesn't quite grab the headlines like utility scale. A megawatt here, a few megawatts there, pales in comparison to multi-gigawatt projects spanning thousands of acres. But NextAmp, the Boston-based community solar developer, is proving scale isn't monolithic. Bit by bit, the company has become one of the most influential developers in the country, both in deploying projects and influencing policy, with a private valuation surpassing $1 billion. That's unicorn status for a so-called small player. I'm John Engle, Editor-in-Chief of Renewable Energy World and Power Grid International. This week on Factor This, I'm joined by Zada Shai, the cerebral CEO who built NextAmp into a forceful DG platform. Ashai shares his outlook for the crowded community solar market, the potential impact of Donald Trump returning to the White House, and why now solar is only the beginning. That's all next on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Zada Shai, great to see you. Thanks for joining the Factor This podcast.
Yeah, great to see you, John, as well.
It's been a long time coming. I've wanted to have you on the show for some time and have been working with your team on this because you and NextAmp have been a great supporter of Grid Tech Connect Forum, our event, and you were in the keynote address at the Northeast event last October. And I, just following your comments there, I knew that I wanted to get you here for more of a long form conversation about, you know, this evolving industry we're in, but some of the challenges that we face. And I think you look at those challenges in an innovative way. And I'm excited to share those with the audience. Before we get too deep into all of these topics, you know, community solar, what's next for NextAmp, what this election year means for all of us, you know, there's a lot to unpack. Can you share a bit about your background and sort of the thesis behind NextAmp for those who aren't familiar?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So first of all, John, thanks for having me on. You know, the background of NextAmp is we're founded 15 years ago, based here in the Boston area. Originally, we were a company that was founded on the premise of trying to make going green easy and affordable. For the first few years of NextAmp's history, interesting facts, we were doing a lot more than solar. We were doing geothermal, energy efficiency, small wind at that time. And we were dabbling in a bunch of different technologies because in the early years, it wasn't clear solar is what was going to scale. I joined NextAmp a little over 10 years ago. And when we joined with our new team, we kind of thought about the customer experience and what technologies made sense. And at that point, we made the decision that based on customer feedback, we wanted to take a vertically integrated approach. We wanted to make sure that from a customer perspective, that we could be delivering what we said we would deliver. And that meant development, building, owning, operating, doing the energy sales component. Eventually, we went to community solar 3 years into my tenure. It was really focusing on creating a really elegant, seamless customer experience. And, you know, the sort of the special thing about NextAmp in our ecosystem is we've married the generation side with the consumer side. And I think that's going to be important as the energy transition continues. I think it's hard to do certain things for customers if you don't have both components of the business on the generation and consumer side. You know, since I've joined NextAmp, it's expanded quite a bit. We have two headquarters. We're headquartered now in Chicago and Boston. We're active in 19 states. When I joined, we were just in one state, primarily in the Massachusetts area. And, you know, for us, it's, you know, the future really is how do we marry that generation and consumer element to continue to accelerate energy transitions in existing markets, but also hopefully new markets as well.
I talked with Sheldon Kimber, Intersect Power CEO, last week about, you know, the changing business models, and everyone's an IPP these days. But when you made that business case and decided to be vertically integrated and an IPP with a specific focus on distributed generation, that was kind of novel at the time. And we still don't see a lot of those well-established national framework DG platforms. And I know you guys do some other stuff and you have some larger projects, but what was the thinking behind that? You touched on it there for a second, but how do you make that work? Because that's so commonly, you know, referred to on the utility scale side where you've got those economies of scale that aid you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So as you alluded to, I think we were taking an IPP approach or integrated approach well before it was cool and apostrophes. And there were a number of reasons we did it. One is we saw that project values and project execution were much better when you sort of had the whole project life cycle under one roof. Number two, we also saw it as a better business model for shareholders. So if you think about it, development by nature is episodic. It can spike and it can go down state by state and even within geographies. The ownership business is obviously consistent. You have recurring cash flows. And, you know, John, a lot of my background pre-NextAmp was in the private equity space. So I sort of took that hat and said, how do you construct a business model that can have sustainability, that can sort of withstand the ups and downs of markets? And we came to that conclusion. It's also, you know, candidly, our management team has always had this kind of mindset. We want to create a sort of a clean energy company from a sort of a blank sheet of paper to challenge the traditional energy incumbents. So for us, it wasn't building an energy company, a clean energy company in 3 years and flipping it to an investor. And again, there's nothing wrong with it, but our ambition has always been, how do you create a company that can last for generations and can also then challenge some of these large energy incumbents? So, you know, the way I think about it is now that NextAmp is well over $1 billion company in valuation and heft, you can do things which we could not do 5-7 years ago. You're not at the kids table anymore on policy decisions. You're on sort of the main table, talking about interconnection issues, talking about federal policy issues, talking about state policy issues. And I think sort of as a parent, and I've talked about this in another interview last week on NPR, as a parent of three kids, energy transition is so important to me. I mean, this is the legacy we're trying to leave for the next generation. I don't trust utility companies and diversified energy companies to make those decisions quickly. I think it really has to come for these pure play companies. And the reason being is they're beholden to shareholders. They have legacy investments in fossil fuels, which they have every incentive to make sure that they drive the last amount of return from. And that's why I think it's important that we have these larger players, whether it's in DG space, whether it's the resi space and utility space, that can force sort of change faster than what we have right now.
You talked about building a company that can survive the ebbs and flows of the industry in these difficult times that a lot of companies are finding themselves in now. So yeah. That thinking is being stress tested this moment. Like this is a tricky stretch that we're in. So how is that model holding up to the high rate environment and supply chain constraints and, you know, grid connection issues? What have you learned maybe about what's good about it and what we maybe still need to tweak or evolve? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I've thought about it quite a bit. It's a tough time to be an entrepreneur and a leader in companies that are in rapidly changing markets, just generally. And if you think about it, as you mentioned, you're going through a high interest rate environment. You're going through a workforce that has survived post-COVID, which has created a public health epidemic, but also sort of created issues with mental health, childcare, and everything. So it's not just supply chain, interconnection, and interest rates, it's tough to sort of reassemble a labor force the same way we did pre-COVID. And people, absolutely. So there's a lot I've learned. I think as an entrepreneur and someone who's still active in the venture capital space, we had probably 10 to 15 years of relatively easy, low-cost capital. And what it incentivized entrepreneurs to do, whether it's in energy or outside of energy, is grow without thinking about fundamental business metrics. So I don't think it matters if you're an IPP, it doesn't matter if you're a development flip shop, it doesn't matter if you're starting a software company. The incentives that investors want was super high growth. That switch flipped pretty quickly a couple of years ago. And it's hard. It's a lot of that muscle memory, that tissue that's used to do high growth is not the same to build sustainability, to build profitability. And as you can imagine with development, there is a certain level of speculative behavior. There's can be irrational exuberance. And I think we're no different as a sector. We're going through it in the DG space, utility scale space, where deals made very aggressive assumptions are harder to underwrite. They're running into the issues you mentioned, interconnection issues, higher labor costs, higher install costs. And I think, you know, what I've learned is growth is important. We're in an industry that if we don't grow, we're not solving the climate issue. So for us, it is absolutely imperative that we grow as fast as possible. But now the question is, how do you think about growing sustainably? How do you think about capital formation? How do you think about communicating your story? How do you think about productivity and process improvement? Something when you're in the early stage of the company, you don't really focus on because there's really no time to. And for me, it's humbling. All right. It's a challenge. I think for everyone in this time, it's you sort of had to go back to the gym figuratively and learn a new skill and learn a new drill and really focus on that. But I think it's been really critical. You can't have blinders on in your eyes and ignore it and just assume the market's going to flip back to the way it's going to be. I do think companies in the clean energy sector will come back stronger from this. But it's definitely, it's challenging. I mean, one line I heard from another much smaller clean energy company was like survive to 25, which I thought was kind of clever. And there's some truth to it. And we're also dealing with some pretty severe issues on the interconnection queue side, on the distribution side, but also on the transmission side, as you're well aware. I think there's a lot of policy and private sector awareness and initiatives around it, but there's no breakthroughs yet. I'm still optimistic there will be, but we're kind of in this phase where we need smart people solving really hard problems.
Yeah, and we'll get more into that interconnection piece because you talk about smart people solving hard problems. I've got to meet a lot of the NextAmp team that is working on these innovative pilots, whether with National Grid or others, on trying to use creative solutions like batteries and non-wires alternatives to alleviate some of these congestion points, and really just saying, we'll be your teammate, utility, and we'll figure this out together. And a comment that I think you left with me at our Northeast event last October was, we need to go from pilot to scale, like, period. We don't have time to keep piloting things that we know can work today. So I'm going to put a pin in that and come back to it. But to round out your you said a couple of interesting things there. The managed growth piece is interesting because I look at NextAmp from the outside as being one of those steady drumbeat companies that I keep seeing the milestones. I see the advancements, but I don't see the trying to grab the biggest headline every week or trying, you know, those big splash moments. It's just like, it's just constant and it's steady. And oh, there's NextAmp again with a portfolio announcement, or there's NextAmp again opening a new office. And you guys are hiring like crazy out of the new HQ in Chicago, while I hear this quiet commentary within the industry, without naming companies, of layoffs taking place all over. The big guys, too, the ones that are looked at as being the leaders. And I think our industry, I've said this a ton of times, especially in relation to the Oxen Solar tariff case, is we have a nature of being the good guys. We're fighting against climate change. It's a purpose-driven industry. It is inherently good. But bad things do happen too, and we kind of have to deal with our mistakes or our overcorrections or whatever there are. And I think we're going through kind of a hiring overcorrection in this industry post-COVID, not to the scale of you know, tech, but I'm hearing about this all the time. And you know, it's very quiet, but it's happening. Are you hearing about that too?
I am. I mean, it's I don't think we're immune from a few things. One is labor costs have increased dramatically since COVID. We're in the energy business. We're not on the software side where our margins are 80-90%. But some things have to give. And yes, I'm hearing it across industry. To your point, I think it is quiet. I think folks are looking at restructuring groups, realigning resources. We're doing the same thing, right? We are looking how do we grow with less? Because I think that's absolutely the right decision in this market. So I don't think we're any different from the rest of the industry. You know, we're evaluating process improvement. How do we simplify things so we can get more projects done with fewer people? How do we think about getting back to a supply chain where costs continue to either decline or equipment continues to get better and more productive? But no, absolutely. I think it's a theme not only in our industry, but unfortunately other industries as well.
And you guys, just to get into the market outlook piece of this, you guys have really made your name in community solar and are one of the bigger players nationally, but you know, huge portfolio in the Northeast, one of the more mature markets that we've got. And looking at what NextAmp's growth trajectory is and how you want to evolve, how big of a piece is community solar in an ongoing basis, or will that one day just become a thing you do as part of the suite of offerings to, you know, your clients? Because just kind of the anecdote there is this is always just chatter that I hear, and then I bounce it off a CEO and make them answer to it. But there is some commentary that I get from those playing in the community solar space that we'll keep trudging along as long as we can and get new markets, but it's tough work. It's very competitive. They're small programs. And at some point, the utilities are going to balk like they did with net metering and say, we're not going to pay retail for this. So I'm curious kind of how you see that all fitting into the long-term scope of NextAmp.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So first of all, I am still bullish and optimistic about community solar. I think community solar is still such an innovative construct and framework that can really drive value. And I think to your comment, developers have to get off this. We're falling into a trap. Like, we're using these sound bites that the opposition's using. Oh, utilities aren't going to pay out this retail. That's all. I don't want to curse on it. That's just baloney.
You can curse anything, here, Zach.
Yeah. So
you can say
anything
you want here.
Yeah. It's just bullshit. It's and the reality is, when you build DG projects, and we've challenged regulatory bodies, look at the value of solar. Look at the environmental benefit. Look at the grid benefit. Look at the full economic benefit. And we did this in the Massachusetts region. And the value of solar, if the tariff was attached to the value of solar, would be so much higher than the retail rate. And again, it's a reaction more to these sound bites. Like, we fall prey to these sound bites. And I think that's challenged community solar and the broader solar industry. If you think about what we've done in the state of Massachusetts, hundreds of millions of dollars of interconnection upgrades, not on the ratepayers, but on the solar industry. Those interconnection upgrades not only allow you to put more solar in the grid, but they modernize a grid for electrification of heat, transportation, etc. So the way I think about community solar is there's a communications problem. We stink at it as an industry. It's almost like we're begging just to be like, get a tariff. It has to be an offensive strategy where it's, hey, here's the value that we're going to deliver. And it has to go beyond jobs and like tax benefits. That's like too basic. You really have to get
that. That's like 10 years ago stuff where it's like, here's the
still
jobs
hear
we created.
I still hear it.
The cars, the one I like the most is the press release that says the cars that got taken off the road by this wind turbine.
It's so old. We got to get better than that.
It just doesn't land, you know?
And it shouldn't land.
And keep going with this point, but it does link back to these stories that are in every major newspaper right now about how do we make the Inflation Reduction Act connect with the everyday American when they go to vote? And that's not really happening. At least there's a perception that the common everyday American does not know about all those investments and what it means to them. I kind of think these things are intrinsically linked.
Hey, Factor This listeners, it's John Engel. I wanted to let you know that you can now watch every new episode of the Factor This podcast on YouTube. Just search Renewable Energy World and leave a rating and review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, so a few things. I think folks in the solar industry and even within NextAmp sometimes, we're energy geeks. We're not communication gurus. We don't communicate to the normal American well. We're designed, and again, it's an evolution of an industry. We're a small industry. We're designed to communicate to PUCs and PSCs or whatever the appropriate regulatory body. We're not out there making a broader political pitch. So if you think about it, community solar is kind of, yeah, you could grow to a certain level by talking to these very specific regulatory bodies. If you want a 50-state strategy, you got to get the buy-in from the mass public, which I'm confident, like head to toe, if we went there and did it well, the majority of Americans, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, would be like, yeah, we love this. When I go there to sort of the general bodies, whether conservatives, liberals, they're like, we love it. Now, there's different aspects they love. They like energy resiliency. They like getting off foreign oil. They like local job creation. They like building a better grid.
Money for schools and parks.
Farmers. If you look at our YouTube channel, we have a great video with one of our farmers who talks about solar as a crop. So we have to evolve our communication strategy. But, you know, if we do that, I'm confident in community solar. I think to your point, we're going to continue to do community solar. We'll continue, you know, we're the largest player in the country. We'll continue to invest in regulatory infrastructure and continue to push on that. Will we do other things to your point? Absolutely. You know, we have a storage portfolio. We have a burgeoning utility scale portfolio, but they're all connected. These aren't things that, you know, have to be separate. You sort of have to have a holistic view. And I think, you know, a few years down the road, and hopefully it's not too much longer, we're going to have these concepts of virtual utilities, right? So the idea is, how do you bypass some of these regulatory constructs that we're living under? Like, I, as a business, I don't want to be beholden to the distributed grid anymore. I want to be able to build virtual utilities where you can combine storage, demand response, generation, consumers, and then start interacting with transmission lines. Obviously, we're nowhere close to that. It's going to take a lot of regulatory work. It's also, to your point, going to take work politically to convince Americans, oh, this makes sense. And I think this is kind of where we are. We're at this really interesting inflection point in the energy industry where there's kind of two paths. I think the decarbonization path is already happening. Trump can make noise about it. Biden can make noise at the federal level. It doesn't matter. Like, every major energy conglomerate knows energy transition is happening. How fast that happens, it's debate, but they know it. But now it's a grid question. And I think this is a fork in the road. I think larger energy companies want the grid to look like it does today without too many changes. So what does that mean? Large mega utility scale projects, solar, wind, lots of transmission lines that they can rate base or get federal monies for, and the distribution grid to stay the same. Where I think the grid should be going is, geez, we can start remaking the grid, make it much more distributed, democratize it, make it more intelligent, integrate resiliency and demand response. Think about unique constructs where cars are power plants too, EVs are, integrating community solar into this, right? And I think the RMI did a great thing about Community Solar Plus. That's what the industry has to evolve to. It's an evolution. I don't think it's a rip it up and it's going to be something different. I mean, sometimes you call it synthetic community solar. Sometimes
we can't do that.
So, but
we talk
but again,
about communicating to the general public. Yeah. If we start getting into that kind of naming structure, you've already started to lose me.
Exactly. So, so I think we're going to enter hopefully a decade of community solar plus. I'm not the marketing guru. I'm sure someone will figure it out. But this is what excites me is how do you connect community solar to the rest of electrification efforts in our country? And I think there's a really good story to be told there.
When you talk about democratizing the grid, are you talking about this virtual utility structure where you're kind of tapping into existing poles and wires? Or are you saying like we need to mix it up a little bit on utility rights in general?
Because I don't want to get in too much trouble with our utility partners, but and utility partners have heard me say this as well. I think utilities generally, and it's going to vary state by state, should focus on transmission distribution, full stop. I think areas utilities should not be involved in are generation and the consumer side. I think the consumer side, they're private companies that can do customer service better and also help them electrify better, period. I don't believe that we should be remaking transmission distribution whole scale. We're going to have to at some level, but it should. I think that's where utilities are very effective. That's kind of my view. So the analogy would be that utilities are, you know, they should charge tolling agreements for using that infrastructure. They should be partners. And as we alluded to in October when we spoke, you know, I've really instructed my team to focus on building partnerships and alliances with utilities, having hard discussions with them as needed, but doing it in the vein of collaboration, which is very different than the industry probably did a few years ago when we were just at loggerheads with each other. And I think that's going to be really the key thing. It takes two hands to clap, as I would say. So the utilities have to believe in that. And I that's kind of would be my vision for it. I think that's also NextAmp's vision.
I'm going to kind of ask you to play devil's advocate to your own point, which isn't fair. But what if you're the utility, what don't you like about that structure? Because if you're just managing transmission and distribution, T&D costs have been steadily increasing for a while now. Generation costs have been steadily declining for a while now. So, I mean, if it doesn't take an MBA to follow that logic, customer service and customer engagement is hard and it's not fun. So, I mean, if you're, at least that's my opinion, if you're to offload that piece, offload generation and just focus on the poles and wires of which you have no competition, what's the position against doing that?
So I think there's multiple threads you could pull from utility. So if I were in a boardroom, I'd say, geez, we're losing this customer engagement piece. There's going to be state and federal monies for electrification, for energy audits. As you know, in Massachusetts, we had a pretty successful program called the Mass Save program, where utilities were partners to look at insulation. At that time, it was changing out light bulbs, heat pumps, less so at that time, but now it's evolving. And they believe there's a value stream there. So I think that's important. I think generation, yes, costs are declining. It's another business line that they can sort of capture. So I think those are kind of the threads. I think then there's a second thread is the ratepayer advocate is going to be like, hey, is the consumer business going to start looking like third-party energy retail, which is super problematic. You know, teaser rates, fraud, deception with customers. I mean, that industry has done such a disservice generally to the consumer experience. And sometimes community solar, by the way, gets caught into that, which stinks. Yeah. And a policymaker like, well, the utility is beholden to us. They have a guaranteed rate of return. We have oversight. We don't have oversight of the private companies, which I would push back. There's ways to do it. So I think those are kind of the threads. I do think utility, look, I've had, I'm not going to throw out names. I've had really good discussions with senior leadership at various utilities. They know the customer piece is broken. They know billing stinks. They know that they don't have the workforce to do that well. But there is a deep-seated suspicion of opening that up as well.
So without naming names, and maybe this is a category to name names, I want to talk about that effort that NextAmp has taken to build relationships with utilities instead of always, you know, positioning it as we tend to do in this industry as adversarial. And it's us versus them. They're the incumbents. We're shaking everything up. We're decarbonizing. And the utility is the big bad boogeyman. Where have you seen opportunities to work together and collaborate to not only expedite your own projects, but look more creatively at this system and how we use it most effectively? I mentioned the non-wires alternatives and interconnection stuff. That program was with National Grid, which may be kind of part of this discussion, but I think you guys are doing more in this space than most.
We are. We're focused on it. So one is a business. We've built a grid integration team, which has an engineering aspect, has a business aspect, has a policy aspect, and it definitely some of the conversations I even spend some of my time on. So to your point, we're trying to invest time through sort of the various parts of an average utility. Because you think about it, we own these projects for the life of the project. So we're living and dying by the performance of a utility with it. So it makes sense for us. It probably doesn't make sense for a lot of other players to make that investment.
And you mentioned team. This isn't just one person, because I know multiple of them. I know Ben Pyru and I know Brandon Bowles. And so for you to have, you know, several people just dealing with this stuff and looking at these innovative solutions is incredibly unique.
Yeah, it's important. And I mean, I think next week's Naruk in DC, I'll be down there. I'm not sure how many CEOs of solar companies are going to be down there, but it's important. I mean, it's utilities. These partnerships are like gold. If we do it well, we're all going to serve our communities. If we don't do it well, it really does slow down the energy transition. I'll give a shout out to National Grid. They have been thoughtful. They have been willing to entertain hard discussions. They have at all levels, and as you mentioned, they've been willing to really think of non-wires alternative, expediting interconnection, using private sector sort of investment from us. They've also now started to think about the customer experience with billing, community solar billing, making sure things are more accurate, working with our billing teams as like a large partner. And that's been super effective. And I think the idea would be like, how do we roll these models out to other utilities, which there are a few other utilities that are in the queue that I'm excited about. But on the generation side, it's going to fundamentally come down to interconnection and how utilities and PUC and PSCs think about it. I think the whole concept of interconnection, especially in the Northeast and some other states, is absolutely broken. The way we're interconnecting projects, and I think I talked about this in October on the panel, is build the largest pipe for those few hours when that solar facility is producing the max amount of power. It's like absurd. You think about like the way we do energy is we produce an electron and we got to use it right away on the grid.
Yeah.
It's so fundamentally flawed. We don't do that with grain. We don't do that with other agricultural products. There's no way we would think about it that way. And interconnection to me is no different. I would love to go to framework where we radically change those frameworks to flexible interconnection, where utilities work with players like us and say, we're going to need to curtail a certain percentage up to this level, but we can now open up queues. Interconnection's cheaper. What it does force us to do is build storage and design the system to become more base load type systems, where we're not just producing energy from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We have to use this infrastructure more effectively. So to me, that's the fundamental issue, is it's a abuse of using this infrastructure has just been, it's inefficient and it stinks. It's not an effective way to do this. And I think now it's coming to a head. Early years, not an issue. Interconnection is relatively easy. And if we want to grow, it's either we expand the grid massively. And I've heard some of our peers in the industry say that, hey, let's use taxpayer funds. Let's use federal funds to modernize the grid. Not saying that that's wrong. There could be an element to that. But it's also like, how do we use this grid better?
Yeah. Do we need to 2X or 3X or, God forbid, 4X the grid?
Well, I've heard, so the estimate in Massachusetts, I heard, won't name this expert, who is very well placed. If we didn't change anything in Massachusetts with all our offshore wind and solar, 8x the size of the grid.
And which and is, I think that's actually in the ISO New England research, because I believe they released a transmission report, was it 2 to 3 weeks ago, that said something like, to meet the needs of 2050, I think it was $30 billion, something like that, in grid enhancements, to do nothing and just kind of keep going is still going to take like $20 billion, you know, just with the way with existing load growth and you know, how the economy is set up. So, I mean, that's incredible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's new frameworks. We have to challenge some of the frameworks that have existed over the last 10 years and change them. The only way you can do that is you need everyone at the table. You need policymakers, you need utilities, you need the private sector, you need some of these new technology companies that are doing demand response and curtailment and fast storage. But there's a way to do it.
I want to get back to that pilot to scale point that I made a while back and said that I'd revisit. You know, just to round out the National Grid topic, I'm not sure if it was National Grid New York or Mass that you did the self-build pilot with. Interested to see how that went, if it's even complete yet. And did you get any indication from Grid on some of these different things you're doing with flexible interconnection pilots or self-build that they're like, hey, this is working or this isn't working, and we'd like to go to that next step?
Yeah, without because I can't share too many details. The pilot's
no one
gone well.
To this podcast. Zach.
Oh, really? Geez, so it's just going to be
no
you and me on it.
Yes, yeah, okay. Just us. You can say whatever you want.
Look, it's gone well. There's definitely things we're learning, but overall, a few high level. It definitely has cut costs and it's increased speed materially, which is awesome. But as you know, it's easy to do a pilot, and it's hard to scale. Like that's always a thing. And I think Grid and us are looking at that. They have definitely been open now to thinking through scale with us and hopefully to the broader community on interconnection, self-build, more non-wires alternatives. We are getting calls from other utilities to look at these types of projects to unclog queues. Because as you can imagine, when utilities go to the PUC or PSCs, they're like, hey, we want a rate base, new substations, new sort of zones and the distribution grid. Ratepayer advocates are skeptical.
Oh, they're getting told no left and right. I've got a story kind of in the hopper. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I've got something on my list that I haven't been able to get to on. Oh, you want to do grid mod? Well, you better have the best case possible to prove that it benefits the consumer today and next week and next 10 years. Because regulators are being incredibly skeptical on these claims and the fears of gold plating the system, that's resonating from the consumer advocates. I think we've seen some of that in Connecticut. You know, Eversource is having a challenging time figuring out how to pay for their AMI 2.0 program. So grid mod is not as simple anymore as just like, hey, we need to do all this stuff. We think it's going to be like this in 2030, 2040, and 2050. Money, please.
Yep. No, absolutely. So this is where these partnerships are going to flourish, because we have a shared objective, even with the ratepayer advocates. Ratepayer advocates are challenging us to do this, and this is no different than kind of earlier in our discussion about doing more with less. You know, high interest rates, all these things also affect tax revenues. States are going through it. It affects how you can invest. The grid, you know, we always think about grids like the only thing. Probably you and I don't think as much about roads, school modernization, and that's probably an unfair characterization. But these policymakers, yeah, I mean,
think about those things.
You think about it when you hit a pothole and things
yeah,
don't work,
that's about it.
And electricity's out. But as you know, we're not the only thing on a policymaker's mind, and sometimes we forget that. So I do think this whole thing about some of these pilots going to scale, they're going to be forced by some of the macroeconomic dynamics politically and economically.
Do you hear from regulators as well, or just utilities that are curious about this? Are you getting like PSC or PUC commissioners being like, Zad, like how did you guys figure this out? What did that deal look like? How do you manage risk? And I think the accountability piece is the other big thing here, is like who owns this shared project that you built for Grid, and who does O&M, who's on the hook if there's an OSHA issue, you know, all those like nitty gritty details. But are you getting those calls too?
So unfortunately, I've not cracked the network of PSC and PUC commissioners to hang out with them and discuss these like in non-public settings.
But Neighbors are the right place to go. Yeah.
But, you know, try to break into that. We'll see what bar they hang out at.
Yeah, that's right. I can give you some tips.
Yeah, these discussions are happening. It's slow because they're looking at it from a very different vantage point. So, you know, you and I, and probably most of the listeners out there, if there are any listeners, are wanted to think, yeah, we're thinking about scale and speed and like the urgency of climate change. PUC and PSC commissioners, they're balancing that. I think they do understand the importance of tackling climate change, But to your point, they're worried about some of these issues, which they should be. OSHA, reliability, quality of work. Is this union labor if you're doing self-perform, which obviously it will be when you have to do utility work. But no, those discussions are happening. What I found, John, is utilities are really good to have those discussions on our behalf. And again, this is where the partnership is, because they've been doing this for 40, 50 years, having these discussions with them on more of the regulatory basis. So the strategy is really making sure the utility partners can, once we get alignment, they can take it there. And we'll be supportive of them and we'll say, hey, we're behind you. But honestly, strategically, they have a much better platform to do that.
That makes a lot of sense when you put it that way. And if you get along with Grid and the project goes well, they can then go to the DPU and say, here's what we learned. We worked with this developer. We were able to find common ground and reach an agreement. And here's how we embedded some of our people to make sure that everything went okay. And then you kind of have all your ducks in the row before you go to the teacher, you know, and you're able to, yeah. or your boss or whatever. You don't want to just come up with an idea and say, hey, can we do this? You want to, you know, be able to present a case that says, here's what we learned and why it can work elsewhere. Was that in Massachusetts? I think it was, right?
Yeah, it was. Yes, it was.
Okay. Any other areas that we should be looking at? I called out the Grid example because I'm just more familiar with that one. But anything else you're involved in or projects even from others that you've seen that you see as, you know, this is stuff we need to be trying more of?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you can imagine, with the Inflation Reduction Act, getting more focus on LMI projects that really deliver significant benefits. So, you know, we did this interesting project in ComEd in Illinois called the Give Array, which folks can see on the website, which we partnered with utility to really make sure that the savings were dramatic for low-income residents. And that was in the city of Rockford, Illinois, which is, you know, it's kind of one of those forgotten industrial cities that's fallen as manufacturing left our country. I think that's one area where it's finally there's a federal policy impetus and there's a state policy impetus. One of the things we really admire about the state of Illinois is they've designed their community solar programs and their energy programs really to think about equity and racial justice. So that's another thread which I'm personally wedded to and passionate about as we create this massive transition the Grid. It's going to create this massive amount of economic opportunity. It has to be done in a way that's very different than some of the industrial booms we've done in the past, where it's just exacerbated inequity rather than flattening inequity.
I've only got you for a few more minutes here, Zad. So I do want to talk to you about the point I made at the top about election years. How are you thinking about the way to position NextAmp for that long-lasting success, whoever's in the White House, if there's a change? You know, you hear these comments from the industry that there's some Trump-proofing going on, whether it's in terms of like procurement or expediting projects. Sheldon Kimber even mentioned to a degree he's got a team that's like crunching the numbers and moving things around. And do we need to push a little harder here or push a little harder there just to hedge our bet on like, and I know they have a number of like BLM projects that they're probably a little more sensitive to, given that it's public land. Yeah. How do you view that?
So we don't have any projects on federal lands. So we're in a little bit different situation than Sheldon is, for example. A few comments. One, this election year is it's very dystopian, right? We have two candidates who I think, without putting my personal commentary in, if you want it, we can figure that out. People are very unenthusiastic about historically. I think the vast majority of Americans do not want a Biden-Trump rematch. I'm not going to make any value judgments on it, but that's where it is. I think that's also probably indicative of that Biden hasn't done a good job of communicating some of his wins. I think the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, manufacturing is booming in the U.S. The economy is like back up and running. We didn't have a recession. But we're in a social media age where communication matters. So we're in this very like apathetic political environment, which increases political risk because we don't even know what the turnout models are going to look like. Trump proofing business. I would love tips. If anyone has it, email me. I don't even know how you Trump proof a business, because in reality, I'm not sure we know what a second term is going to look like in reality. But a few things, obviously, as an industry, we got to get to a point where we don't go back and forth with election wins. And I think this is an issue that we have, is the climate change movement has to get bipartisan support. We can have differences about market incentives, how things are funded. Like, I wish we were at that point. We're not as a country. Does President Trump have a radically different vision of the energy world? Absolutely. Is that a threat to all of us? Absolutely. But the question is going to be come to is the best way to Trump proof, quote unquote, a business is we got to win state elections. We got to win the House. We got to make sure that we show up to elections where PUC or PSC commissioners are elected. I wish our industry did a better job. We should be training and getting candidates there. So to me, yes, does the president have a big impact on energy policy? Is that something we should be collectively concerned about? Absolutely. But I hope we don't. Sometimes progressive and Democrats always think about the top of the ticket rather than the base of the ticket. I think conservatives are so much better about building grassroots. And I think the environmental movement has to do a better job. So for me personally, I'm optimistic. I'm trained that. I'm not despondent about these choices, but I'm also really focused on trying to support, mentor candidates in different offices that have an impact on environmental. Because if there is a Trump presidency, I think there's ways to fight and ensure that we continue the energy transition. Will it be more challenging? Absolutely. I'm not going to put lipstick on a pig type situation, but we got to show up, and we have to show up in this federal election, but we got to show up in some of these elections where turnouts don't matter. You know, I think about the Georgia elections we had where there was a sweep of senators, but they didn't show up Warnock for the PUC.
Ossoff.
Yeah, but they didn't show up for the commissioner, the PUC commissioner. The more progressive clean energy commissioner lost the election because there was no like investment in that. So that's that's where, like, again, I'm only like one little tiny piece of this whole thing, but that's where I'm focused on.
It's a really good example, though, because who were two of the most influential senators on shepherding the Inflation Reduction Act? It was Ossoff and Warnock, two newbies.
Correct.
Like, Ossoff was the author, I think it might have been both of them, authored the Solar Energy Manufacturing for America Act, SEMA Act, which later enveloped into Build Back Better, rest in peace, and then into the Inflation Reduction Act. And so that was a very consequential election for the clean energy movement. And it's always interesting to come across people who are surprised to learn the influence that state-level policy has on fighting climate change and advancing clean energy. Because when you think about, especially with the distribution system, you've got 50 states, 50 PUCs or PSCs. I mean, that's a lot of influence. Like, transmission grid is important, but that's a lot of power. And you can make a ton of impact on the distribution system as well. So in thinking about that Trump line, just for one more second and closing us out here, you don't seem worried that a change in the White House could spell the end for the Inflation Reduction Act, or that it would be, you know, overly neutered after, you know, in a second term Trump presidency.
John, the honest answer is, do I have concerns? Absolutely. I think it's a foregone conclusion if Trump's elected, the Inflation Reduction Act is gone? Absolutely not. I'd say I'm somewhere in the middle. A few things. Trump or his policymakers have extolled the virtues about building manufacturing back in the U.S. The domestic adder does that. So I'm not sure why they rationally would do that. The other thing why I'm also optimistic, and again, we can argue this both ways, there's a lot of manufacturing. I mean, MTG's district in Georgia has a Qcells factory. Senator Cruz talked about Jay Solar opening up manufacturing in Texas. Some of the really good investments that are being made on the manufacturing side are all in red districts. So how is Trump going to make his case? Like, all those jobs, they're all being shut down. because I'm going to make it. I mean, Trump likes being popular. So how do you sort of address that? And
good point.
The LMI equity, I'm concerned. Is the DOE going to sort of think about centering equity? No. There is no way in hell that's going to happen. Yes, as a citizen, I'm concerned about these choices. I'm also concerned that Americans are apathetic. I'm concerned about other issues, which is going to affect my workforce, racial justice, reproductive health. Those they affect us. It's not only a reproductive issue. It affects labor. In this recent ruling in Alabama about IVF and embryos, these have real life consequences, not only to individuals at home, but individuals at work. And that scares me. And it scares me also just more broadly, you know, put the IRA aside, because we obviously, I've heard a lot about Trump and the IRA, what kind of political and social unrest do we have in that situation with a president we've seen in the first term? Now, again, we're an industry who survived that first term. We hunker down, but doesn't mean that I'm sort of by any means like sanguine or excited about a second term. I think it could be extremely problematic on multiple levels, not just in energy.
I'd be a horrific host to end on that note. So I'm going to kind of flip around and ask what excites you. And I like doing this with everyone I talk to. But what, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. You've been in this industry in various capacities. What excites you most about what you're doing today that you think maybe others aren't paying attention to enough?
I think we're finally crossing the chasm in solar and community solar and the energy transition. To your point of this analogy of going from pilot to scale, we're finally there. I look at the average American, irrespective of their political affiliation, wants more solar and wants more wind. I look at the boom in new technologies and EVs, even though they've hit some road bumps. You look at ICE cars are declining in sales, EVs are still going up. I look at the fact that more Americans are, and especially young Americans, are centering climate change as the most important or close to most important issue in their vernacular when they think about choices they make. And I also look at corporations and banks that are centering climate resiliency, climate justice, equity. These are things that are really important. So, you know, for me, elections don't define America. I mean, they impact us, and elections are important. So I don't want to down this. But America is defined by individuals and stakeholders. And on that metric, we're at such a different place in 2024 than we're even like 5 years ago. And that's a testament to people who made investments in the late 90s. That's a testament to Jimmy Carter's administration. And it's kind of like this wave that's continuing to build. And despite some rocks and pebbles and speed bumps have been thrown at it, we're starting to like continue to crest. And we know the impact we can make on our communities. We know the impact that we can create on health and other issues. And it's just that it's a matter of time. And, you know, I meet with young folks. You know, I just joined this board of governors at Brown University, which is my alma mater. But we have to be optimistic. We have to understand the gravity of the moment, but we have to be optimistic for the next generation and the generations after that. And I don't underestimate the ingenuity of humans. I think the one thing that I hope comes through the climate change movement, it connects humans. It makes us less tribal. And the one thing that I always see, I was like a political science buff, like I accidentally came into NextAmp into business, is this kind of erases those barriers. We're all connected in this. And I think once you're all connected, amazing solutions really do happen.
Zad, this was a ton of fun. I always learn a lot every time I talk to you, and I love your perspective and thoughtfulness on this stuff. And I think it's obvious how thoughtful you are. And we didn't even mention the Brown and the Harvard ties to the audience. So now they get it too. You've proven that that resume.
It's just a school, right? These are just schools, and I was very fortunate to be at them. But thank you, John. It's been a great conversation, and look forward to staying in touch.
Thanks again to Zadashai for joining the podcast. Factor This is a production of Renewable Energy World and Clarion Energy. Join us every Monday as we break down solar's biggest stories with industry leaders who actually move the needle. And please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Factor This from Renewable Energy World. Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.